Hey, this is Jeff Fry, former Toronto Blue Jay, and you're listening to the Walk Off Podcast with Scott and Adam.
Baseball, Blue Jays, and more baseball. It's the Walk Off with Scott Belford and Adam Mack.
This ball is crushed.
The Die Hard Podcast for the casual fan.
And another one.
Good morning, Mr. Mack. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing well. Just woke up nice and early to watch Team Canada win a gold medal. So
wasn't that a fun soccer game? Unreal.
I'm not
a big soccer guy, but those ladies killed it. Congrats to Team Canada's women team for winning the gold medal soccer this morning. Yes, that was great. And buddy, 1 week after the trade deadline, and we've got lots to talk about here. The Jays have been doing nothing but winning. We're going to get into Adam Simber, who has just been dominant in the bullpen. We are going to go over the six-man rotation. Some decisions need to be made here between Steven Matz and Ross Stripling as to who is going to the bullpen next week. And then we will also break down a Tony La Russa moment at the end of the show here. All right, and my sound is fixed. Hey! For those of you who have struggled through my tinny sound over the last 2 weeks, see, I rebooted my whole system on my computer, and being the old, technologically deficient person that I am, did not even think to check the Zoom settings. And so, despite talking through this microphone, I was actually using the microphone on the computer. So this was just a dummy decoy microphone.
Just a prop comedy here.
Just to show off that I'm an old man. So that's perfect. But yeah, sound is much better here. Our guest today, very excited. We actually managed to sit down with Jeff Fry, formerly of the Toronto Blue Jays. Of course, in 2001, he was one of only two guys to hit for the cycle for this team. I know Kevin Biggio has done it since, but one of only three to hit for the cycle for the Toronto Blue Jays. We get into all sorts of baseball talk with him. We'll get to him in about 30 to 40 minutes here. Of course, all of our guests are brought to you by YourRate.ca. Darren Brown, the mortgage broker, sure to help you get into that mortgage you're after, whether it is a new mortgage or you're redoing your current one, YourRate.ca, to do it online, paperless, and COVID-friendly. Buddy, we are 8 games over 500 currently. The Toronto Blue Jays taking 3 of 4 against the Cleveland Guardians, swept Kansas City 6-1 in the last 7 games. Being back in Toronto, holy cow, has this rejuvenated this team, eh?
Yes, sir.
They have looked incredible, and you can just tell that there's an excitement in that clubhouse to be home in Toronto, to have bolstered this lineup like they did, getting Jose Berríos and deepening this bullpen with Soria and Brad Hand. But who has really impressed in that bullpen? And we're going to get into Adam Simber here, because the guy has been incredible since the Jays picked him up. What's really wild about this trade too, Adam, is that they did it about 3 weeks before the deadline. They really jumped the gun on getting bullpen help. And they did it for Joe Panik.
Yeah.
I mean, they gave up Adam McInvale as well, a prospect that was in AA. But, I mean, to get Adam Simber, who is under contract for another 2 years after 2021, to get Corey Dickerson, who has already started to contribute to this team, coming back off of injury. He got his first hit and RBI a couple days ago. For a guy, and listen, Joe Panik, all the respect in the world, a premier utility guy in the league, can play multiple positions, professional hitter. But let's just look at what Adam Simber has done for this team since joining the Toronto Blue Jays. He's pitched 13.1 innings. He's allowed six hits, one run, 10 walks. Or 10 Ks, I should say, zero walks. He's got a 0.68 ERA and a whip of 0.5. Walks, hits an inning of 0.5. Like, are you kidding me?
That's
unbelievable. That's the right word, man. elite. Now, obviously, not to dance on anyone's grave here, but if we're going to go over Joe Panik's numbers since becoming a Marlin, he's hitting a paltry 145 for his batting average. Yep. He has struck out 18 times. He has struggled. So far, and I mean, Joe Panik is a guy who was really good for this team, utility dude, but his contract was up at the end of 2001, and for what they managed to bring in for him, pretty impressive, dude.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, they really needed somebody in this bullpen who could pitch in high-leverage situations. Adam Simber might, I mean, he got his first save yesterday, and we might see him in that position more and more as we get to the end of this season because he has been lights out, man.
Mm, absolutely has. Is he, where does he rank in our bullpen right now? Is he a top two guy, top three
guy? I think
guy?
He's a top two guy, right? Where would you put him? I don't know if I put him above Romano, but probably pretty close, and it depends on the situation.
I mean, Romano gives me a little heart attack sometimes.
He does.
I do. I feel romantically attached to Romano as our closer.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say that, you know, if we're up 7-6 in the seventh inning and the starter's leaving the game, if Simber's the guy coming in, that's probably the safest I'm going to feel.
I agree. Yeah, he's probably the guy who gives me the most confidence at this point. If I'm the manager, Simber is probably my number one guy right now.
Yeah.
And, I mean, bullpens always shift, especially when there's no designated closer, which is kind of how the Blue Jays have done this, is closing games by committee. But I think right now, Adam Simber is probably your top choice for a high-leverage situation. When you need outs, Simber's who I would go to.
Yeah.
So, big series coming up against the Boston Red Sox. Starting tonight. And Boston has been struggling, man. The Jays are 5 games back of them currently for that number one wild card spot. The Jays are only, 2.5 back of the second wild card spot?
Exactly, yeah.
Like, it's crazy what this team has done over the last week. They are right in the thick of things here. Making up some big ground on Boston would be beautiful, but I'm not going to bet on a sweep. But boy, 3 of 4 would be a beautiful thing, my man.
Sure would.
And some numbers here on the Boston Red Sox, because their rotation has been struggling. So Martin Perez, in his last 11 starts, has a 7.13 ERA. Nick Pivetta, Canadian kid, in his last 13 starts, 5.43 ERA. And Garrett Richards, in his last 9 starts, has a 7.36 ERA. So this is a starting rotation that is struggling currently for the Boston Red Sox. And Toronto, on the other side of things, with a starting rotation that has just kind of really been solidified over the last month. They've all looked really good. So some major ground can be made up here. I know yesterday they wound up taking that game against Cleveland 3-0 and taking 3 of 4 from a very good Guardians team. And there were some moments yesterday that made us all nervous.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so let's start with Bo Bichette winning this game offensively, almost single-handedly. 2-run home run, a single scoring an RBI, getting Simeon in there. I think it was in the 7th. But in the 8th inning, Vladdy took a fastball off the hand, right off the pad. Like, literally, the baseball gods were smiling on Toronto last night. He stayed in the game. Everything was fine. But, man, that is a moment where collectively Blue Jays fans, the team, even baseball fans in general, kind of held their breath because, oh, my goodness, dude. That could have been
anybody needs.
It could have derailed this season. Like, yeah. I don't wish to overstate it, but yikes.
Big time.
So many small bones in your hand, man, and you see guys go down all the time for this sort of thing, and it just definitely made me think, thank goodness that he's wearing all sorts of equipment at this point.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, we saw Kevin Biggio struggle early in the year, and a lot of his early struggles were chalked up to the hand injury, something wrong with one of his fingers, right?
So, yeah.
I mean, even if it's not a season ender to Vladdy, even if he starts hitting like 240 because he's got a, you know, dislocated whatever knuckle or like, oof.
Yeah, man.
That'd be a pretty big impact on this team to lose one of their biggest bats or have it severely reduced.
And you know what, man? Just very thankful for Vladdy himself. He is in the middle of a career year. He's challenging for the MVP award. He's still in the thick of it for the Triple Crown, which is insane. And yes, he's fallen a little behind Ohtani on home runs. And it's weird to say he has been slumping a little lately. But, I mean, when Vladdy slumps, he's still one of the best hitters in the league. So, yeah. You know, slump away, kid. Do your thing.
Yep.
And we're getting to a point, too, here where some decisions are going to need to be made for this team for the starting rotation. So they're rolling with a six-man rotation currently because they've got a doubleheader on Saturday against Boston and then another doubleheader against Los Angeles against the Angels on Tuesday, which, by the way, I'm going to be at that game. Very excited for this. We do our live stream there. Adam's going to be doing it on his own, but I'll be calling in with some cut-ins from Angel Stadium.
You'll be our Ben Wagner.
I'll be your Ben Wagner, everybody. But anyways, good thing that they've got a six-man rotation right now, acquiring Jose Berríos. He's been great, or was great, in his debut with the Blue Jays, right? Getting that win, looking really good, showing off his big slurve that he's known for.
Yep.
But we're going to need to make some decisions. Of course, when I say we, I mean the front office and Charlie Montoyo, as to deciding whether Ross Stripling goes into the bullpen or Steven Matz. Do you have a preference?
I've always been partial to Matz over Stripling.
Okay, I like that. And you know what? Steven Matz has put a lot of work into his mental game. And that's been one of his biggest roadblocks his entire career. And we've seen it on this team. Steven Matz is a guy who will flip out from time to time. He'll get pulled. He has a little bit of a freak out. Not good mentally.
I mean, he's not yelling at Joe Panik for a throwing error.
Absolutely, we can say the same thing about Ross Stripling. But I think that he has put some real effort into this. Steven Matz has. He was injured and he came back off of the IL. He has looked good. Maybe, do you have Matz's numbers up over the last month?
For the
last
month
couple starts?
So he is now pitching around a 4 ERA with K per 9 just under 9. So
yeah. Yeah, Steven Matz has been good. And you know what? He's looked really good in the last, I think it's 2 starts since he's come off the IL. But he's been really good for this team. Maybe it's 3.
No, well, he had the one, he got touched up against Boston. So
that's
he only
right.
pitched 3 1/3 inning. And,
that was his first game back too, correct?
No, I believe his first game back was against the Mets the week before.
Right. You're right. You're correct there.
Sorry, no. He's had 4 games back from injury. So he's played Texas, the Mets, Boston, and Cleveland. Against Texas, he pitched 5 shutout innings.
Yes.
Against the Mets, he pitched 5 2/3, giving up just the 2 runs.
Mm-hmm.
Got touched up by Boston, who's cheating. We all know that. So we'll give him a pass there. And then 6 shutout innings against Cleveland.
I think you keep rolling with Matz. Here is one of the reasons why I'm on the fence. In all honesty, I don't really care who goes into the bullpen. I think either way, Stripling or Matz have been fairly decent as starters this year. But Ross Stripling does have some experience in the bullpen. He is a guy, too, that has been a starter, flipped to the bullpen, back to a starter. So I don't think it's maybe quite as big of a mental hurdle to do that, to kind of have that bullpen be ready at any time, short burst kind of mentality.
Right.
So I wouldn't be surprised to see them move Stripling into the bullpen just for that reason alone, that he's done it. He's been there. And there is a lot to be said for that.
No, there is. And it is definitely, I mean, as much as the amateur watching at home, myself included, can't really wrap my mind around, like, what's the difference between being a starting pitcher and pitching out of the bullpen. Like, you're just throwing the ball, right? It should just be the same thing. But there is definitely a difference in terms of daily routine, the mental aspect of just being ready to go, right? Like, I mean, Ryu is famous for, you know, he likes his, what is it, 5 days rest?
Yeah.
Don't schedule me on short notice. Like, I want to.
In fact, he's even a guy who,
for this start, for the last 5 days.
He's even a guy, when you're talking about Ryu, that is probably even better on 6 days rest, which is wild. Yeah. Great transition here, because I did wish to talk Ryu really quick. He actually got his first start in Rogers Center as a Toronto Blue Jay. Of course, he was the big free agent signing in December of 2019. It is so crazy to think that this team has been away from Toronto for so dang long. Like, man, that first game back in Toronto, I was getting emotional. Like, this is what a baby I am. Like, I was watching the pregame and I'm just like, oh man, it's so nice that they're home. Like, but you could tell it meant something to the players too. I mean, old Charlie Montoyo, he was tearing up as well, and you could see the guys, just the excitement running through it, and just the smile on Ryu's face as he hit the mound for the first time, and watching all the Koreans in the crowd cheering him on, because of course Toronto has a massive South Korean population there, and they haven't had a chance to go and celebrate one of the best Korean ball players to ever play.
Yeah.
So it was very, very cool to watch happen, and Ryu with Toronto. So he's had 33 starts, 190 innings pitched. He's 16-7. He's got a 3.03 ERA. He's got 145 Ks. He's got a whip of 1.14.
Wow.
2 walks per 9 innings. And a 5.7 wins above replacement.
He's just as rock steady as you could ask for.
If that doesn't say ace, like, I know he's probably the unsexiest ace in baseball, because he doesn't throw 100.
Yeah.
He's got 6 pitches and he darts it all around, right? So it's not quite as eye popping to watch him throw a 85 mile an hour slider in the dirt and then a 100 mile an hour high fastball. But my goodness, the guy's numbers are one of the tops in the league. And he does it quietly. He does it under the radar. Even as a Jays fan, I don't probably give him enough credit for what he has done for this team since becoming a member of the Blue Jays.
No, absolutely not.
So my question to you is, freshly acquired Jose Berrio, Robbie Ray having a career year, wild card, one game.
Ooh, wild card, one game.
Who are you pitching? I almost am at the point where I'm like, not going with Ryu, what are we doing? You brought him in to be the ace. He has proven he is the ace. His numbers show it. And yes, he had that blip on the radar in June where he wasn't locating his changeup. But as long as he's continuing to pitch like this, I think personally, I go with Ryu. But I'm very curious as to where your thought process is on this.
I think any of those three guys I feel fine with.
Okay. Yeah, and I'm kind of in the same boat there, too. I wouldn't be.
I know you are.
Yeah.
I feel like because Ryu is a guy who is very particular about not pitching on short rest and anything like that, I think for me, for a one-game wild card, I would only pitch Ryu if it happened to fall on his allotted day that he's supposed to pitch.
If he lines up, you go Ryu. Like, if his start lines up with where the wild card game would be.
Yes, then I would roll with Ryu, and I'd be happy to start Ray in the following series.
Yeah.
But let's say he's pitching on 3 days rest or even 4 days rest.
Yeah.
For the wild card game, I would be shocked to see us pitch him on short rest.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is another interesting aspect to what we're talking about here, is that we're going to be in a dogfight. The Toronto Blue Jays, this is not going to come easy. They're 6.5 back of the lead of the division from Tampa Bay. They're 5 back of Boston for the
first wild card
spot. And they're 2.5 back of Oakland for the second wild card spot.
Could we win the division still?
I honestly believe we could still win the division.
That's insane, how much this last week has changed things.
This week has been wild. And this is why you and I both were screaming from the rooftops. They, of course, are buyers. Why would they sell? They're too dang close and have too big of a run differential to write this season off. And here we are, 2.5 back. And it's what, man? What is it? August 6th. There's still 2 months of baseball left. 2.5 games is nothing. 5 games is nothing. Especially going into Boston with them slumping and the Jays 6-1 in their last 7.
Look, we're doing what we got to do. We're beating up on the bad teams, right? Sweep the Royals, take 3 out of 4 from the Guardians. If we could take 3 out of 4 against Boston, we're laughing. But honestly, yeah, I'd be happy to walk out of there with a split.
For sure. I'd take a split.
That being said, we still have one of the easiest schedules in baseball for the next month and a half, right? We got the Tigers, we got the Nationals, we got the Orioles again. If we're splitting with the Red Sox and we're beating up on the Tigers and the Orioles, now let's not look past the Tigers, who are red hot.
Red hot. Best team in baseball other than, I think, Houston since the beginning of June. I bring up the dogfight because there are going to be some teams, probably the division leaders, that are going to have a week or two to start manipulating their starting rotation to line things up for the wild card or that first game of the division series. I don't think that freedom is going to be allotted to the Blue Jays, because they very well might not clinch a playoff spot if they get one until the last few games of the season. So they're going to be in win mode all the time, and I don't think they're going to have that two-week window come September 15th where they're like, well, if we skip a start here and move a rotation piece here, then that way we line up Ryu here on proper rest. I don't think that's going to be something that they're going to be able to do. Maybe they can.
Not at all. Do you know, so the next month is pretty easy, but do you know what our series are for the last half of September?
No.
We have Tampa Bay, the Twins, Tampa Bay, the Twins, the Yankees.
Holy cow. The whole season could be decided right there.
Yeah.
Let's talk the Yankees for a second, because they're right in this dogfight with us.
They're rolling, yeah, absolutely.
They're one game ahead of the Blue Jays currently, which puts them 1.5 back of Oakland. Oakland might be out of this thing in the next 2 weeks.
Yeah.
With the way the Yankees and the Jays are playing. What are the Yankees at since the trade deadline? Because they've been hot too.
They are 6-1 as well.
So they're also 6-1. So the Jays have not gained anything going 6-1 over the Yankees. But both teams have just continually climbed closer and closer to Oakland and closer to Boston. Who knows? Boston might be the team that actually winds up falling out of this thing, man. Like, obviously, I do not wish to overlook this four-game series, but if something crazy happens, like the Jays take 3 of 4, or my goodness, like, I don't even wish to say the word sweep, but, you know, let's say something crazy happens, and all of a sudden the Jays are 1 game back, or 3 games back, of this Boston Red Sox team going into Monday. Like, buddy.
Yeah.
It's a whole different world.
No kidding.
Yeah, a whole different world. Okay.
A lot of stuff has to go right for us to win the division still.
Absolutely.
The fact that it's even, like, a conversation is incredible.
What's been really interesting, too, is that how much this feels like 2015. With the front office kind of putting their chips in, you know, they going out and getting Jose Barrios for Austin Martin and Simeon Woods-Richardson, two of the top five prospects in the Blue Jays system. Like, that's really going all in.
It is.
Which is exactly what Anthopoulos did back in 2015. And we're starting to see similar results here. This team is excited. This team is ready to win. And they are loving it. I know that the Instagram story of Alek Manoah and the little dance party that the team was having there went kind of viral. But it does kind of show, even though 2015 and 2021 is mimicking each other with what the Jays did front office-wise, talk about two different teams.
Mm-hmm.
Jose Bautista, Edwin Encarnacion, Josh Donaldson. Just such a older veteran presence. Hard asses. Right? Like, those three weren't guys that were having dance parties.
Yeah, that's for sure.
So it's, I mean, obviously I loved that 2015 team and they were incredibly fun to watch. Two ALCS appearances in a row there in 15-16. But man, this team is very exciting. I think I have more fun watching this 2021 version of the Toronto Blue Jays.
Pretty hard.
And I'm excited for this youth that they're doing there. Speaking of Josh Donaldson, I did wish to bring this up. Just a little fun little piece of Toronto Blue Jays history here. Brett Laurie actually made his MLB debut 10 years ago with the Toronto Blue Jays. Isn't that wild?
That's unreal.
It felt like just yesterday he was our big, most hyped prospect. Yeah. This is a guy who had all the talent in the world and just couldn't really put it together. Canadian kid, which probably boosted his hype even higher on this Toronto Blue Jays team. And his first game with the Blue Jays just increased the excitement. Langley, BC boy, batting ninth. He was starting at third base. He singles to center field in his first at bat. Getting his first major league hit. He went 2-for-4 that game. Helped the Blue Jays win 5-4 over the Orioles at Camden Yards. The excitement for Brett Laurie was through the roof. Right? Yeah. And I bring him up because we were just talking 2015. Josh Donaldson, of course, they traded Laurie, Kendall Graveman, and Franklin Beretta, I think it was.
You're right.
For Josh Donaldson. Boy, did the Jays ever win that trade. I mean, Laurie just kind of disappeared off the map, never really could put it together as a full-time player, struggled with some injuries. Kendall Graveman went from a starter, and I mean, he's been a dominant piece in Seattle's bullpen. He just moved. He went to Houston, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so he's in Houston's bullpen now. Franklin Beretta never really panned out. I don't know, man. Looking so back,
you're drawing the parallels to the Austin Martin trade.
Well, it is a good point of you never know what prospects are going to turn out to be. And I did kind of like the comparison of bringing in Jose Berríos as to if things worked out as well as we could hope for Simeon Woods-Richardson, that he is Jose Berríos. I think that was you that pointed that out on our live stream.
Someone in chat did, I think.
Or someone in chat did. And it's a good point, though, right? If everything went well, you want Simeon Woods-Richardson to be Jose Berríos.
Yeah.
And then it cost us Austin Martin to bring him in now.
Yeah. I think that's the most positive way to look at it.
Yeah.
And I think it's a fair way to look at it.
I mean, we have already talked about this trade to no end, so we don't need to deep dive into it again here. But I do think that you just cross your fingers and you hope that the farm system is good enough on this Toronto Blue Jays that no matter how good Austin Martin and Simeon Woods-Richardson become, that it's not going to be a detriment to the team. That there's going to be guys like Groshans and Aroldis Martinez, and who knows, maybe this Gunnar Hoglund they just drafted this year that pan out and take those guys' spots, and it doesn't affect this team in any way in the future. That's the dream, right?
Absolutely.
All right, my dude. Before we move on to the MLB stuff, I did want to bring up Rowdy Tellez, who is having himself a time in Milwaukee.
He's liking it over there.
Fun to watch this kid succeed. There was really no place for him on this Toronto Blue Jays roster. Of course, they got Trevor Richards for him. They needed bullpen pieces, and so they moved Rowdy. You got his numbers? Because they're pretty impressive.
Yeah, so Rowdy Tellez did have a bit of a hot streak and has cooled off a little bit since then. But since going to the Brewers, he is hitting .378 with 5 home runs and 16 RBI.
Wow. And they are loving him. The Brew crew are loving this man.
How can you not love Rowdy? How can you not? Like, he's just a big teddy bear, right?
He's fun to watch play. He's excitable. And he's a guy who plays a good first base. And when he's hitting for power and he's hitting for average and he's on one of his hot streaks, how do you not love him? I wish him all the best. I hope he continues it. We've seen Rowdy get hot before. Like, the Toronto Blue Jays fans know that he's a bit of a hot and cold dude. So while he's succeeding right now, all the power to him. And wish him all the best with the Brewers. And hopefully the Brewers and the Blue Jays get to see him up close and personal in the World Series if we're going to get real wild and crazy. So all the best to Rowdy.
Love it.
We'll wrap things up here. Did you have anything else to add Blue Jays-wise before we move on?
I just wanted to mention again with this 4-game series against the Red Sox starting today, couldn't have lined up better for our pitching rotation as we've got Manoa going tonight, Robbie Ray, Berríos, and Ryu all pitching in these 4 games. So
we could take 3 or 4 here. The starting rotation is lined up to do just that. So fingers crossed. And while we're talking Blue Jay still, I did wish to bring up George Springer, who is our $150 million man that everyone in this fan base has been waiting for, injured most of the season, but has been literally carrying this team's offense in the last week or two. And I think Adam's got the stats up here to prove it, but the guy has been out of this world. Everything that we could hope for. What's he at for games played? Let's start with that.
He is at 39 games played.
39 games played, and then listen to this stat line.
So he's hitting .288 now after a slow start. So he's hitting over .300 since the All-Star break. 13 home runs, 27 RBIs in 39 games.
Like, he's hitting a home run every 3 games.
So what's that? What's that for a pace? 162.
50 something?
Yeah, 54 home run pace.
Like, unreal.
Like, he has a shot at still hitting 30 home runs this year.
That's insane. It is insane to think that George Springer could hit 30 home runs this year. And his OPS has been incredible. This is a guy who...
He's having a career year for OPS. 995 right now.
Yeah, like, I mean, it's just insane. Very excited that we've got this man locked up for another 5 years. And when you watch him play on your team in person, you do get a little bit higher understanding of what a great ball player he is. He does all the little things right. He goes to the plate with a plan. He plays a really solid center field. Even his route to the ball when it's hit in the air has impressed me. He's made some really clean routes that just, you know, we've watched this outfield for the Jays be adventurous at times over the last few years. And don't get me wrong, Teoscar, even Lourdes have improved greatly. Mm-hmm. Randall Grichuk is what he is out there, a solid defender. But my goodness, it just feels like such a better defense when George Springer is in that outfield. All right, let's move on here. I do have one thing to touch on MLB-wise. We spend all this time crapping on Tony La Russa that I did wish to take a moment and acknowledge something that I was impressed he did. Now, some of you may have seen it. John Boy even did a little feature on it. But what happened was that they were playing the Cleveland Indians, the Guardians, my apologies, the Cleveland Guardians. This was last week. And their pitcher for the Guardians was wild. He was all over the place. Okay, and this is a guy who throws 100 miles an hour. I should have looked up who it was here before we started talking about, but nonetheless, it doesn't matter. The point of this story is Tony La Russa. So wild, the batters need to get out of the way of a few wild pitches, and then the catcher calls an inside fastball, and it comes in and it hits the guy in the head. Tony La Russa runs out of the dugout. Now the catcher is very concerned. This was not intentional by any means, by the way. This was just an accident. And the catcher is bent over the White Sox player as Tony La Russa comes in and literally pushes him off of him, right? And gets him back. And then he starts giving the catcher crap. And the catcher's like, "What do you mean? That wasn't intentional." And La Russa's like, "I know it's not intentional. I didn't say it was intentional. What I'm worried about is that he's wild and you're calling an inside pitch for a guy who throws 100 miles an hour." And the catcher was just beside himself, right? He was like, "Well, what do you mean? It wasn't intentional." Anyways, fast forward to the press conference afterwards, and that's exactly what La Russa said, and I loved it. This is standing up for your guys in such a good way and in a way that is psychologically putting it in the head of this catcher that he can't go inside when the guy's not on his game. Okay. You know, just a little gamemanship there by Tony La Russa, 76-year-old Tony La Russa.
So he's saying, "I know it's not the pitcher's fault. It's your fault.
Your fault. You shouldn't have called that inside pitch."
How do you feel about that?
I liked it, man. I think it was a good move. I think that next time the Guardians play the White Sox, they're going to think twice about coming inside when the guy's not hitting his spot.
Because they're worried that Tony La Russa's going to come and wag his finger?
No, I think it's just going to be in their head, man. I mean, he made a good point about the guy. Like, the guy hit him in the head with a 98-mile-an-hour fastball.
Yeah, I don't know. If I'm that pitcher, my next appearance, I'm thrown right back inside. Like that, you got to get right back on the horse. I can tell you right
now. You do.
If that was Alek Manoah, high inside heat with the next pitch, Manoah doesn't give a shit.
Yeah, it's true.
Well, I love that about him.
Yeah, I love Alek Manoah too for that exact reason.
All right.
Well, did you have anything else? Russa.
No, let's move on. Although interesting stat was mentioned.
Oh yeah,
the other day, Tony La Russa, as a manager, has been involved in over 2% of all Major League Baseball games in the entire history of the league.
In the entire history of baseball,
he's pitched in.
Managed in,
over,
yeah.
Sorry, I said pitched in. Managed in over 2%. That's wild. 1 out of 50 games, he's coaching. That's insane.
This is a stat, too, that when I heard it, I didn't believe it. This was a stat that I actually had to go over the numbers and be like, holy crap. Mm-hmm. This is actually for real.
It's insane. Which
since 1874.
That's crazy. It's crazy. Tony La Russa has been drunk at 1% of all Major League Baseball games.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. All right. So we'll wrap it up there with a little tidbit on Tony La Russa. Thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in. We appreciate the Walk Off community so much. Of course, you can follow us on Twitter at Walk Off Podcast. You can follow us on Instagram, the Walk Off Podcast. Please subscribe and like. Comment away. We do our mailbag every Tuesday now, which means that we'll go over your comments or your questions or whatever you may have for us, and we'll kind of answer that before the live stream. We do live stream every single Tuesday. I'm going to be in Los Angeles for our next live stream. Please tune in. It would be great to have the Walk-Off community following along. All right, everybody. Take care. Cheers.
Runner goes, trying to steal third, and that one is belted to left center field, and that baby's gone.
Hey, this is Jeff Fry, former Toronto Blue Jay, and you're listening to the Walk Off Podcast with Scott and Adam.
So thrilled to be joined by today's guest, former major leaguer who played for the Texas Rangers, Boston Red Sox, Colorado Rockies, and our Toronto Blue Jays. Host of the She Gone podcast, Jeff Fry. Welcome to the Walk Off, man. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Yeah, guys. I am happy to be here.
You even ran and got that jersey behind you for us. Jays fans are thrilled.
That thing's always hanging there, man. You know that.
Yeah, that's right. All right. Well, it has been a wild 18 months, obviously. You and the family staying sane and safe through this whole thing?
Yeah, it's been pretty good. We've been pretty fortunate, knock on wood. We got our vaccinations, and my son had a little bout with COVID and a few of our friends, but it's never really gotten too bad here in Texas.
Yeah. Well, it is nice to see the world starting to kind of fall back into place here. I don't know if there are that many silver linings, but I guess one of the good things, if you're going to pick one, is that the pandemic has allowed for a lot of creation and a lot of content to be made. I know in January, you kind of started getting on the content game with the She Gone podcast. What inspired that? And tell me about She Gone.
Well, it was a friend of mine had a podcast, a Rangers Nation podcast, and I went on his podcast one day, and I started getting so many requests from this, the She Gone stuff, that he suggested that I start a podcast. And I was like, all right, it might be fun. I mean, I know I have a lot of buddies in the game that, you know, I think people would like to hear what they have to say. And so just kind of did it. The She Gone just started as an accident. You know, I made a funny video and said She Gone at the end of it. And my buddy goes, you should hashtag She Gone. And I was like, what does that mean? I didn't even know what that meant. And so I did. And I mean, now it's taken off. And I've probably
done it everywhere. Yeah.
I've probably done 300 interviews.
Wow.
That is so awesome. I know it's funny because sitting down with great baseball minds and just talking the game, like, we love it here, obviously, on the walk-off. What have you enjoyed the most about it, and what has kind of surprised you about the process as you do this?
I think what I've enjoyed the most is just reconnecting with a lot of my old buddies in the game, you know, and it's crazy how life is, and you retire and you just kind of go on with life, and you regret not keeping in touch with all these guys. And now all of a sudden, man, I've got, you know, in September, I'm flying to Atlanta to do a baseball camp and a golf tournament with Otis Nixon.
Oh, wow.
That's so cool.
You know, I've gone to Cody, Wyoming and helped in the Celebrities Against Cancer charity event where Jeff Nelson, Denny Nagel, Mike Hampton, so many athletes were there. I mean, it was incredible. Otis Nixon, his brother, John Rocker. And some of these guys I played against, but never really played with. So, you know, you just don't develop those friendships. But now we're friends. And it's really cool, a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, man, that is very cool. Otis Nixon, there's a name I haven't heard in a long time. It's funny, as a Jays fan, I was like 10 or 11 when they won those World Series in 92 and 93. And Otis Nixon, I mean, on that Braves team, he was just grease lightning. I remember just as a kid being like, how can somebody be that fast?
We played together in Texas, and he was a leadoff hitter, and I was a two-hole hitter. And, man, it was pretty nice having him on base because I got a lot of fastballs. And I knew that once just getting on first base, he was in scoring position.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, him on first base. Exactly. That's right. Yeah. I know I really loved watching your Twitter crusade about launch angle. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that aspect of the game. I know that the three true outcomes has become a big deal in baseball. It's what we see all the time. And I know sometimes you watch coaching of today try to, I don't know, for lack of a better word, kind of shoehorn every player, every body type, every age group into one way of doing things. What are your thoughts on baseball's recent obsessions with launch angle and exit velo? Is it the be all and end all?
No, I think it's terrible for the game. And I think that's why the league is hitting 241. I mean, if you think about it, the best players in the world, right, are in the major leagues. People from all over the world that are the best in their country, their goal is to come play in our major leagues, right? And the very best in the world can only hit 241. That's not even one out of four. And it's just amazing to me that people have bought into this is the only way to do it. All the pitchers are too good now. And I think it's hurting the game, and especially because it's trickling down to the youth, right? And so these kids are striking out and they're hitting pop-ups, and a lot of them are going to quit because it's not any fun to not have any success at a young age. And we have to, you know, if we want to promote this game, we got to get these kids wanting to play like we used to play.
Well, while we're speaking the game then, I'm curious what your thoughts are on the sticky stuff scenario here. Obviously, when you played, products like Spider Tack didn't exist. Even spin rate wasn't even a stat yet, you would say. But I did find this interesting. So since the crackdown, strikeouts are down 25%, which is the biggest monthly decrease in MLB history by like almost triple. Hit by a pitch is down 10%. I guess what I'm saying is pitchers were obviously cheating, and it affected the game in some way or another. What is your thought on the whole sticky stuff crackdown?
Oh, I'm so glad they did it. It was, I watched a lot of baseball and see a lot of highlights, you know, and I just saw the ball moving differently than I'd ever seen it before. You know, a baseball is too heavy normally to move 3 feet in the last 5 feet. And you think it looks like a wiffle ball.
Yeah,
it does.
The way that the hitters had no chance. And now all of a sudden you see guys who signed huge contracts because they turned their careers around all of a sudden. And now these guys are just human again, and they're not, you know, they're not superhuman. And I think it's great. I mean, unfortunately, they think they allowed it to trickle down again into the college and high school ranks, because I've heard stories that those kids were using it too.
Yeah.
So I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, those kids are going to go into pro ball and not be able to use it. And then these teams are going to go, wait a minute, I thought this guy was good when we drafted him.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because we're talking launch angle and we're talking the sticky stuff and just how it does trickle down to the youth of what they're doing and what is being produced as a baseball players these days. So do you think that when it comes to the kids coming up, that it'll just self-correct? Like, there was all this talk about, are they going to need to move the mound back? Are they going to need to do these drastic rule changes that kind of change the integrity of the game? But maybe it was just the sticky stuff. And if we can start finding ways to teach ball players that there's more than one way to do than just hit a home run, strike out, or walk. Like, do you think that it's going to self-correct?
I hope so. You know, it's funny you mentioned the mound being moved back, because today's the day the Atlantic League starts their experiment by moving the mound back a foot. And
how do you feel about that?
I think it's horrible.
Right? Okay.
it's unfair to these guys who are trying to revive their careers or establish a career to be used as guinea pigs by Major League Baseball. And, you know, all the fingers point to Rob Manfred, the commissioner of baseball, and his rule changes. And I think I wish the players would refuse to do it, because I don't know what the league would do then. If the players refuse to play, how are they going to have a ball game?
Hey, at least minor leaguers are paid well for it, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, those guys are making bank.
It's funny you say that, Jeff, because I didn't even think of how frustrating it would be just for the guys in the Atlantic League to need to do that. You know, I was more thinking, oh, I hope this doesn't go through to the major leagues. But my goodness, like, what a detriment to need to put in front of these guys as they're trying to develop their own careers.
Yeah, it'll never make it to the major leagues. And that's the funny part, is that, you know, why even bother experimenting with it? Because there's no way in hell the Players Association is ever going to agree to this. No way. So it's a waste of time. And it's so bad that, you know, the commissioner in that league, Rick White, has said that coaches, managers, and players are not allowed to speak out publicly about these rule changes, or they will be punished or blackballed from the game.
Wow. Jeez. They can't even threaten a fine because they know they make no money.
Exactly. I mean, it's terrible for the game.
So you, my man, we'll call you a Jeff of all trades positionally. Well before baseball was moving guys all over the diamond, you played second, you played third, you played some outfield. How difficult is it to be a good utility guy who's expected to be defensively versatile. And I'm curious if you think with how much teams move guys around the diamond in today's game, if it has hurt the defensive side of the game at all.
It's pretty tough, but I mean, it was for me being a middle infielder playing the outfield, I thought it was easy.
Okay.
My glove was twice as big. And my manager wanted to get me in the lineup in Boston, Jimmy Williams. And we had signed Jose Offerman to a four-year contract, and he was the second baseman. And that was my primary position. So he asked me if I could play other positions. And I wanted to get in the lineup any way I could. So I said, sure. He goes, can you play outfield? I'm like, sure, Jimmy. I just if I don't catch it, I'll just hit the cutoff man. You know, it's no big deal.
And, yeah.
You know, so I would have like five or six gloves in my bag, not knowing where I played, but I really didn't like playing. Third base was the one position I really didn't enjoy playing.
Right.
And I didn't play. I didn't think I was very good at it.
Is that why you didn't enjoy it as much? Is you just didn't feel as confident there?
Yeah, well, I had an average to below average arm. And so I had to do everything right on a routine ground ball just to get an out. And
right.
The angle that you're at third base is so different from second base. And what I learned at when I made a bunch of errors one time in Boston over about a week of games. And I noticed that I was asked some guys about playing third base, and they said, don't look at the runner. So I was looking at the runner, and it seemed to me like he was pretty far down the line, and I would have to rush my throw, and I wouldn't make a good throw. So once I stopped looking at the runner and just focusing on the first baseman, I got better at it.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
That's interesting. Just kind of psyching yourself out.
Well, I mean, when you're playing, when you have a long throw at third base and you know you don't have that great of an arm, it just adds pressure, you know? It's like I have to throw a perfect throw every time or I'm gonna make an error and look like a jerk out here.
I feel the same way every Thursday night when I'm playing slow pitch.
So your professional baseball career started in 1988 when you were drafted by the Texas Rangers, and then it was a four-year grind in the minors before you got the call up. And I know a lot of people don't really grasp what a mental grind that can be, how difficult it is to stay focused on a goal from year to year. What was that like for you, and what was the experience of finally getting that call up and that validation like?
Well, see, I never thought of it as a grind. I mean, you know, you kind of have the late in the summer when you're getting kind of tired and wore out, it gets tough, but man, I enjoyed every minute of it. And I was like, man, I'm getting paid to play baseball. What do I have to complain about? I mean, I wasn't getting paid a lot.
Yeah.
I was getting paid. And I mean, I loved it. And, you know, those 4 years, basically the reason I had to stay in the minor league so long is because I was not a prospect. I wasn't a guy who was, you know, given a lot of money out of the draft, and I was an organizational guy, and I just had to succeed at every level to even make the major leagues. And once I did make the major leagues, I mean, that's just like a dream come true. You know, you dreamed about this your whole life as a kid, you know, just in the backyard thinking about what it would be like watching your heroes, and all of a sudden you're on the same field. So it was, man, it was really cool.
Oh, I can imagine. And it's funny because baseball really has been a sport that's all about player development all along, right? It's about developing your talent within your organization. And it took you 4 years of development to get there. I'm curious what you see as the biggest difference in player development between when you were coming up in 88 through 92 to right now, and how teams are developing talent now.
Coaching.
Okay.
I had some great coaches in the minor leagues, and not every one of them played the game, but, you know, professionally or in the big leagues, but they played the game at some level. They had some level of success. They knew, you know, what it was like to fail. They knew how hard the game was. And I think what we have now is we have a lot of people in player development who have zero playing backgrounds, and they're basing all their teachings off of data and statistics and analytics, and they just don't get it.
Yeah. Do you think the game will swing back? like, it feels like the pendulum has become very analytic heavy and has kind of swung all the way to the other side here. Like, there is a happy medium between, obviously data is important, but there's a happy medium between knowing baseball and analytics, right?
I think it's going to have to, because people are going to stop watching.
Yeah.
There's just not enough action in a game. And I mean, it's tough to watch for me. So when it's tough to watch for me, right, how is it for the casual fan?
No, for sure. It's like, I know we just kind of touched on the strikeouts and home runs and the launch angle and the sticky stuff. If you were to do something to try and, I guess, correct what's going on, what does baseball need to do?
We need to bring back baseball men in the game. We really do. There's so many former players out there that would love to be coaching.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of them don't want to do it because they can't speak their mind. And they're afraid of the repercussions. Even the guys who are former players in the game can't speak their mind either, because the people in charge have their own ideas, their own agenda, and they don't want these guys getting in their way.
Yeah.
Right. It's like the front office just wants a puppet who will just do what we say. We've got the analytics. You just roll. Like, we'll send you a text message. You change the lineup as we say and just go from there.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. I mean, these guys are making in-game decisions. They're taking the control away from the coaches and the managers. And, I mean, I know Cash claims that he decided that, you know, Blake Snell was done. But everybody watching the game is like, how is he done? How could you possibly take this guy out of the game in the biggest game in the history of your organization?
Yeah.
He's dealing, and he breathed life into the Dodgers lineup. Those guys were doing cartwheels in the dugout.
Oh, of course they were.
It's true.
And look what happened. They lost. And I think it's awesome that the baseball gods got them going against the traditions of the game and using this analytics and stuff to try to outsmart everybody, and they lost.
Last year's playoffs was incredibly frustrating as a fan. The analytics side of things was more prevalent than I had seen in a long, long time, maybe ever, because there's more examples than just Blake Snell. I know, even as a Jays fan, watching guys be pulled out where it was obvious that they were doing it, like Matt Shoemaker, right? He pitches two brilliant innings at the beginning of that wild card game against the Rays, and then they removed him because they had planned to remove him days ago. And it just seems like such a weird thing when it comes to baseball to already know when you're taking your pitchers out before they're even pitched.
Yeah, and I wonder too. I wonder, I keep going back to the Rays, but I'm wondering as a manager, okay, if you know the game plan is, all right, this guy's in no, it's not happening. He's not facing the lineup the third time through. I don't care what he's doing, okay? And if this dude's going out there and just dealing, and you get closer to the point of the game where you have to take him out, is the manager kind of hoping maybe he gives up a few hits so it doesn't look so bad?
Yeah.
It looks really bad when you take a guy out when there's obviously not a good reason to take him out of a game.
Yeah.
It's that third time through the lineup.
Yeah.
People just look at that. They throw everything out the window because of that stat. It's wild. So how do you feel about La Russa being back in the game? Because that's a pretty big swing the other way.
I'm happy.
Right?
He's a great baseball guy. And you know, I know people want to point in today's society, you know, you make a mistake and they want to, you know,
straighten you up by your thumbs. Yeah.
Life, you know, you made a mistake, you're done. But he made a few mistakes off the field. But the guy's a great baseball manager, great baseball man. And I think it's obvious his influence has done to the Chicago White Sox.
Well, they are the best team in the American League right now. So he's doing something.
What a shocker, right?
Yeah. So I want to talk about a crazy day in your life here. In 1996, you wind up getting released by the Rangers, and then that same day signed as a free agent with the Boston Red Sox. Man, what a wild day. Like, what was that experience like? The highs and lows of that must have been wild.
Well, there really wasn't a low, because the only reason I got released was because the Red Sox had already inquired about me, and they were going to, they wanted, I had a clause in my contract that is called a side letter that said any major, because I was in AAA, any major league team that wants to acquire me can bring me directly to the big leagues, but the Rangers have to decide if they want, if they would have to call me up instead. And they decide, Johnny Oates, the manager, he wasn't a fan of me. So once the Red Sox inquired, they were having troubles at second base. The Rangers let me go. So I went basically right from Oklahoma City right to Boston.
Well, that sure is Boston-ish. A nice little clause to have in your contract. How did you swing that? That doesn't sound like something everybody's got.
No, I don't think you can do that anymore.
All right, we can leave it at that then.
It was really cool because Kevin Kennedy was the manager of the Red Sox. Okay, Kevin Kennedy managed me with the Rangers. And he got fired for some unknown reason and went to Boston. Well, Kevin, one of Kevin's agents at the time was a guy named Billy Martin Jr., Billy Martin's son, okay, the legendary Billy Martin. And we were buddies. And so Boston was really struggling at second base. Cordero got hurt. He was more of a shortstop. Jeff Manto was a third baseman. So they had a big hole at second base. And Billy called Kevin and says, the guy you need at second base is playing in Oklahoma City, Jeff Fry. And Kevin's like, is he available? He goes, yeah, he's available. You guys should try to get him. And that's how they got me.
That's awesome. I love that they kind of had you as a target. That's fantastic.
Well, I found out that one of the coaches of the Rangers was telling them that I was in Oklahoma City, that they should try and get me too. Dave Oliver was a good buddy of mine with the Rangers, and he knew that I really belonged in the big leagues, but the manager didn't like me. So I was going to die in AAA as long as I was a Ranger.
That is great to hear that there are coaches like that that will go the extra distance to try and help a guy out that they believe in. That's awesome, man.
Yep.
Boston's such an iconic market, too. What was it like to play at Fenway? Like, to call Fenway home? You had a heck of a season in 97, too. What was that first year as a Red Sox like?
Oh, it was amazing. To go from Oklahoma City, the fairgrounds, AAA, to Fenway Park.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was a dream come true. And, you know, another side note to that story was we were playing, I think, in Buffalo, and I was playing outfield, and I pulled a quad muscle, and I'd been setting, I had a hole in my quad. I still do to this day, but it's like half a golf ball, a hole right in the middle of my quad. And I didn't play for a few days, and my agent calls me and says, hey, the Red Sox want to acquire you, but you haven't played in a few days. Are you healthy? I said, yeah, I'm fine. I lied through my teeth. And so I go to Boston, and I walk in Kevin Kennedy's office, and he goes, so how come you haven't played in a few days? And I said, well, you want me to BS you or tell you the truth? He goes, I want the truth. I said, well, I've messed up my quad about 4 days ago. And he goes, oh, how bad is it? And I said, it's pretty freaking bad. I said, he goes, what percentage are you? I said, and it's hard to judge what percentage you are, you know? But I knew it was bad. I said, I don't know, Kevin, 60% probably. I said, but I can tape it up. I'll tape it up as tight as I can and give you everything I got. And he goes, well, 60% of you is better than what we got. You're in there tonight. Wow. That was like July 8th or something like that. And from that point of the season, I got right around 500 plate appearances in 2/3 of a season.
Wow.
What a wild ride too, because the next year, and I mean, you just talked about it, right? You had that quad injury, and injuries happen in every sport. And as a fan, it almost becomes an afterthought. You know, a guy gets injured and then he goes on the IL and he's out of sight and out of mind. It almost kind of takes the human side out of it. And I know you missed the entire 98 season with a knee injury. How difficult is that for an athlete to miss substantial time due to an injury? Like, I can imagine it's pretty maddening at times.
Well, it happened to me twice. I missed two full seasons, 93 after my rookie year, I tore my ACL playing basketball. And in 98, I hurt my knee in spring training. And it's, I mean, you feel like you let your team down, even though they know you don't want to be hurt.
Yeah.
You just don't feel like you're part of the team because you're not doing anything to help the team. You're kind of in the way, you know, and mentally it's tough to try and feel like, you know, you want to be part of the group and do everything you can, everybody pushing in the same direction, but it's definitely tough.
Like when you hit the IL, I can imagine there's times where you're not even with the team, right? Like you're not even around the guys.
Yeah, the first year in 93, I did my rehab in Texas, and I was not really with the team. I would go occasionally to the ballpark after it'd been a while, a few months in, then I would start going to the ballpark. But basically, I was going to see a therapist to do my rehab, you know, at an alternate location. And then in 98, you know, I was got hurt as a Boston Red Sox player, and I did all my rehab in Texas. So I was really not even around the team.
Are you calling guys? Like, how do you go about just keeping yourself mentally cohesive with the team? Like, is it an impossible? Like,
it's pretty impossible. I'll tell you a funny story though. So I was in Texas, rehabbing, and the Red Sox were coming to town, and we had a pitcher on our team, Aaron Seeley, in Boston when I was there. Well, now he was in Texas, and I read an article in the paper where Aaron Seeley said, it's nice to have a strong middle infield now. Basically a jab at me and Nomar.
Right.
You know? And I was like, did he really say that? And so, you know, he had Kevin Elster and Kurt Stillwell up the middle is apparently better than me and Nomar.
So, okay.
I got the article and I cut it out. Right. And I went to Boston and I taped it on the training room door. So everybody that walked in there knew that this guy said this. Our old teammate, you know, is now in Texas saying this about us. And so, everybody was pissed off. And Nomar and Scott Hattieburg were good buddies with Aaron Seeley. And he walked up to them and they both just totally like talked to the hand, man. No, you're not part of our team anymore.
You can't shit talk us and then expect us to be friendly. Yeah.
I mean, come on, you know, and he probably thought, there's no way these guys are ever going to see what I said because I'm in Texas and they're in Boston. But little did he know.
I had lots of time.
Yeah.
So this year's trade deadline, I mean, honestly, it's funny. This year in baseball has been really great with the youth that we're watching come up and just how exciting some of these guys are. And the trade deadline actually had a lot going on. Just guys moving, all-stars moving. And you experienced your first trade July 27th, 2000, when you went from Boston to Colorado. Is being traded as weird a feeling as it to me, it looks like it would just be such a difficult thing to kind of come to terms with. And obviously how you feel is different from individual to individual, but what was that experience like on your end?
Yeah, it was tough, but you know, I pretty much caused myself to get traded. I ripped the general manager in the paper in the Boston Globe, Dan Duquette, because I thought he was doing a lot of us wrong and mistreating the players. And so you know, the headline in the Boston Globe said, Fry rips Duquette, and a couple days later, I get traded. And, you know, so then I go to Colorado, and fortunately, I had my best friend was the video coordinator for the Rockies. He was a teammate of mine, Mike Hamilton. And so that was cool to have him there. And I'd played with a couple other guys on the team, but the difficult part is when you go to a new team, is you feel like you're starting from scratch. You know, these guys don't know anything about you, and you feel like you have to try and impress them right away, you know, and it's difficult to do, and you put too much pressure on yourself to do that, and I think it hurts your performance. I mean, look what happened to Lindor so far this year.
Yeah.
I mean, he wasn't traded. Was he traded? I don't know if he was traded or signed as a free agent, but you go from Cleveland, where there's no pressure, right, to New York,
where there is pressure,
and you got a $300 million contract over your head that everybody's expecting you to be this superstar. And you put all this pressure on yourself, and then look at, he's done terrible this year.
Yeah, he has. I think he'll be fine next year. But yeah, that first year, I can imagine it would be tricky. How tough is it to do mid-season? Like when you were traded literally halfway through the season, is it trickier? No spring training to kind of like, you know?
And actually, the hard part is just relocating because I got traded, flew from Boston. No, I think it was Oakland maybe. Flew to Milwaukee to meet the Rocky. I fly to Boston. I get to Boston at 4 a.m. I have to, my wife at the time was in Texas, so she wasn't there to help me. I had to go get a couple of the clubhouse kids to help me load up my apartment in a you know, like a U-Haul. I'm paying one of the guys to drive it to Colorado. Right? I have to pay for my car to get shipped to Colorado, and then I got to fly out that night back to Colorado to meet the team to be ready to play the next day. Wow.
So you always hear about trades and you forget about the, oh yeah, they've got a life they have to move on top of baseball stuff. Like, yeah, that's wild.
Well, I was exhausted.
Of course.
Yeah, I mean, loaded up at, you know, I had a little boy at the time too. So the 2-bedroom apartment with all of our stuff that we had no idea we were even leaving overnight. I'm traded. I got to pack up the entire place and get back the next day for a baseball game.
So you might be able to answer this. You always hear about Coors Field and how it's much easier to hit for power there. Is that truly the case, or do you think that sometimes guys in Rockies uniforms don't get given the credit they deserve?
Well, I think it was different before they started the humidor stuff. I mean, right. A lot of, you know, obviously if you're a mile high elevation above sea level, the ball's going to go farther. But
yeah,
the ballpark is bigger. And I think, at least when I played there, my experience was – it was just so much room to get hits. The field was just no way these three guys could cover the entire outfield. It was huge. And then the ball on top of that would travel, I guess, 7 to 10% further. And it was just, it's kind of different, kind of weird to get used to just playing catch. You can notice the ball travels different.
You mentioned,
well, with a big, sorry, Adam, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you mentioned the humidor there. And I know we have a lot of casual baseball fans listening or watching on YouTube. Do you want to just briefly explain what the humidor is in Colorado and what the purpose of it's for?
Yeah, that's where you put your cigars. No, they apparently, I don't really know how it works, but apparently they put the humidors, they put the balls in this humidor and it makes the ball travel like it was at, I guess, probably sea level instead of a mile high. And it, I guess it basically deadens the ball a little bit so it's not flying out of the ballpark, kind of like the, you know, they happened in baseball in 2019 when all of a sudden, you know, Titleist started sponsoring Major League Baseball.
Titleist. That's great.
Yeah, it's funny. You talked about Coors Field being a big park and feeling like you could hit it all over. That's where not concentrating just on launch angle actually helped you out pretty good there, I'm guessing.
Yeah, it did. I mean, I was never a power hitter. I wasn't supposed to be. You know, you weigh 165 pounds and you're 5'9". You weren't supposed to hit the ball in the air. And, you know, I was hitting line drives and ground balls. And I think I hit 350 something that year for the Rockies. And you know, the bummer part of it was after the season, the GM comes up to me and says, "Hey, you and your agent, don't forget about us. This, you know, free agency." I said, "Okay, man." And they never called. So obviously I didn't impress them enough.
Well, this is where Blue Jays fans are probably pretty glad that that happened. In December 2000, you wind up signing with the Blue Jays. What was that process like? Were you waiting on other teams or was Toronto appealing to you at the time? What stood out to you about the Toronto's front office pitch to you?
Well, I had a few offers, not really many. And, you know, I always liked going to Toronto as a visiting player. I thought it was a really cool city. And you know, at that stage of my career, I was basically a utility type player. And what you do is you look at the roster of the teams that are interested in you, and you look and see if which one, you know, you think you have the best chance to get an opportunity at. And it looked, you know, nothing against Homer Bush, but it looked like I had the opportunity at least to go to Toronto and get some playing time. So that's why we decided on Toronto.
And you had a career moment. I know Jays fans are well aware of your cycle that you hit there, August 17th, 2001. And I remember watching the game, buddy. It was just so exciting. Like, I was 17 and just like, oh my God, this is crazy. Where does this rank in your baseball accomplishments? This had to have been a pretty crazy and special night for you.
Yeah, it's right there at the top. I mean, that, and I hit a walk-off home run in Fenway one day. That's up there too. But yeah, the cycle was, the story of the cycle is I've told it so many times. But,
I can imagine.
and the bummer part of that year was I hurt my knee in spring training. And like the first week of spring training, something popped in my knee. And I rehabbed it and tried to come back. The first swing I took, it popped again. So I had to have surgery. I think the doctor took out my stitches a little bit too early. I got a staph infection. So I had this machine hooked up to me for a week, right? It had like in my veins or whatever. And I had to wear this thing everywhere I went. I had to take a bath with this thing hanging outside the bath. I couldn't take a shower. It was horrible. And so Homer Bush breaks his thumb, and I was in the Florida State League on a rehab assignment, and I played 4 games. I think I was nowhere near ready to go to the big leagues.
Right.
And sure enough, they called me up, and I'm like, oh shit, I'm going right to the big leagues, and I'm in the lineup right away. And I got 4 games of spring training under my belt. And so, you know, that whole year, my knee bothered me. I had to tape it a special way because it popped every step I took, which was really weird to get used to. But the cycle day, I wasn't even for sure I was going to be in the lineup. You know, I was playing sparingly. We had some young guys. We weren't doing that well. And all of a sudden I show up, and I knew we were playing the Rangers. I knew Darren Oliver was pitching, and he was my teammate and good friend. And I show up to the field, and I'm hitting ninth, playing third base, you know, against Darren Oliver and my old team, the Rangers. And so that, you know, that's kind of how it started. And you guys know the rest. I mean, I hit a bloop double. And then, you know, Ricky Lede, I need to send him a Christmas gift because he helped me out twice. A bloop triple actually bounced over his head on the turf. Then the double, he misjudged it and came in and went over his head. Then I hit the homer that barely was fair and barely was over the fence, you know, and all I needed was a single. You know, I'm a single hitter. You know, and I turn it into a single. But, I caught some flack for that. But, you know, I had already gone up to Cito Gaston in the dugout before I went up and says, hey, Cito, what do I do right here if I hit a ball in the corner in the gap? And he goes, stop it first and tell him I told you to. I said, are you sure? He goes, yep. He goes, we're winning by 8 runs in the 8th inning. We got this game. And sure enough, hit the ball in the gap and stop it first. And Kelly Gruber's there.
Is also very cool that Kelly Gruber, the last Jay before you did it to hit for the cycle, was in the crowd. That's wild.
Yeah, and he wasn't even there originally. He was in town in Toronto at like an autograph signing. And apparently they called him up and says, hey, you need to get over to the stadium. You know, this guy's Jeff Fries, you know, needs a single to hit for the cycle. So he came over to the stadium. I mean, and I had no idea that Kelly Gruber was the only guy in history. Right? How many great hitters have the Blue Jays had over the years?
Yeah.
You know, and it's only one had ever hit for the cycle. And so he comes on the field and smacks me in the head. And I said, man, you can read my lips, but in the video it says, of all the people to hit for the cycle, it's me. And he's so that was really cool.
Can you name the most recent Blue Jay to hit for the cycle?
Biggio.
There you go.
Yeah, absolutely.
Another second baseman.
I'm not the last Blue Jay here for the cycle anymore. So
no.
Yesterday's news.
Yeah.
Well, Jeff, we really appreciate your time here. I'm going to throw it to Adam here. We do a segment called Foul Territory. So, Adam, take it away, buddy.
Okay, I got two questions I want to kind of get to with you today. I know you'd mentioned earlier in the conversation, reconnecting with some of the old players that you grew up playing against and developing friendships with them and stuff. Pro golf has a seniors division, the Champions Tour, I think it's called. Why doesn't baseball have a Champions League for guys such as yourself, some 50 plusers, to get a nice little pro league going? Maybe with obviously a shortened season, we're not going to throw you guys out there for 162. But do you think there would be any interest? I know when we talked to Sean Green a couple months ago, he actually really loved the idea. Do you think there'd be much interest in a Champions Tour for Major League Baseball players?
Would you play in a 40-game champion style season there, Jeff?
Well, I would do it for sure. They do have a league. It's called Slow Pitch Softball.
Well, I'm in that league, though. That's not really.
I'll tell you a funny story. I'm about to start playing in a 40 and over league, and I've never done that. My buddy asked me if I wanted to come out, and he played up to AAA. And apparently, the double play combination on this team is going to be me at second and Ian Kinsler at shortstop.
What? Wow.
And who at one point I was his agent. So that is going to be, you know, really cool. But,
that's cool. Well, you got to get these games. You got to get these games televised, man.
Yeah, I think, you know, from my experience playing a couple years of slow pitch softball with some bunch of guys my age, there were a lot of injuries, man. So I don't know. I think that might be the only thing that, you know, the guys wouldn't want to do it because a lot of guys' bodies get beat up playing for 15, 20 years.
Fair enough. We'd have to modify some rules, like no sliding, like every base
move
you can run through
back.
It. Like at first.
Move the mound back.
Move the mound back.
Sounds good. All right. And the next question, I know you mentioned being an agent, and that kind of leads into my next question is with the, I don't want to say looming lockout that lies ahead next season or this off season. There's always potential for a stoppage in play when a CBA needs to be negotiated. So as an agent, and I don't even know if you're freely able to talk about this, but how would you approach an off season where things are so uncertain? Would you be encouraging your guys to, like, let's sign a deal because we need a big bonus? Like, we might not play ball next year. You know, you need a little goose egg to get you through. Or would you be doing maybe the opposite where, you know, you're feeling good, like the players are going to win this one, so we don't want to sign anything long term because if we wait 12 months, we might get an even bigger payday. Like, how does that get approached from a business side of things?
Well, it's tough, and I think the players are in a good position because I think the game is not very good right now, and I think there's so much negativity coming because of the commissioner's office, because of the commissioner of baseball, and, you know, all these rules changes and things that they're trying to implement to improve the game are doing the exact opposite. They're hurting the game. Okay, viewership is down. And I think these owners are going to say, wait a minute, we're not going to get these big TV deals if people aren't watching the game. We have to get back to playing this game the way they've played it for 150 years, all right? And we're going to have a happy medium between the analytics side and the baseball side. And, you know, as long as the players stick together like, you know, they have every other year, I think they're in a good position. I think it's in everybody's best interest to not have a work stoppage because you know what that does to the fans. Mm-hmm. They get pissed. How can millionaires be, you know, they're too greedy and they don't really understand all the details of what's going on. But I think having a work stoppage with the way the game is today and the viewership would really, really hurt this game.
Yeah, baseball really can't afford to right now because they're kind of having – they're in such a good opportunity if they can capitalize on it with so many of these young kids who are just absolutely electric out there, right? Like with Fernando Tatis and I know Acuna, he's hurt right now, but, you know, Vladdy in Toronto and everything. Like there's a real opportunity.
Five of them up there in Toronto.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
You know, you got Bichette, Biggio, Vladdy.
Oh, we're spoiled right now, and we're aware of it.
Bunch of young studs, man. Yeah, I mean, there's so many good young players throughout the game. Just phenomenal talents, and you know, I think that you know, those are the guys that people want to see. I'm very thankful they're playing baseball in Toronto. Finally.
Oh, me right? too.
But I'm also happy that the Texas Rangers got to go to Buffalo and play because my client, Jonah Heim, is from Buffalo, and he got to play in his hometown.
That's so cool.
I don't know if you guys know who Jonah is, catcher for the Rangers. On Saturday and Sunday, he became the first player in the history of Major League Baseball, the first rookie to hit back-to-back walk-off home runs on a – Saturday and
wow,
Saturday.
That's so cool.
I missed that. That's awesome.
And he's from Buffalo. He's actually from Amherst, but Buffalo's right there down the street. And he got to go home, and all his family and friends got to see him play in Buffalo before.
That's really cool.
Blue Jays went back to Canada.
I love that. Jeff, how are you on time here? I've got a few listener questions for you. You got a few more minutes?
I'm good.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. So you did sort of touch on it there, but this first question, and I know Adam was just talking about it too, but Jenna in Toronto says, "Hey, Jeff, super cool you're doing the podcast. I know after you retired from the MLB, you became an agent. What inspired that move, and do you still have some clients?"
Yes, actually, what inspired it was my last year, I felt that my agent bailed on me. He had been my agent my entire major league career, and it was after the year in Toronto. And I called him. I was home. Spring training was already started, and I didn't have a job. And I said, "Hey, man, what do you got? You got anything?" He goes, "No, man, I don't have anything." He goes, "You know, I'm really busy with arbitration cases with other players. Why don't you make some phone calls on your own, call independent league teams and all this?" And I'm like, "What? Okay, so why do I need you as my agent if I need to make calls, right? Isn't that your job?" Yeah. So he bailed. And so I had an opportunity to become an agent as soon as I retired. And I was like, yeah, you know, I would like to do that. I also had opportunity to become a scout, and I didn't want to be gone all the time. I didn't want to be gone all the time. But being an agent, I could do that from home. And I had little kids, so I wanted to be home. And so, you know, 19 years ago, I became a certified major league agent. And at one point we had, I think, 12 big leaguers in our stable. Right now I only have one big leaguer. It's Jonah Heim, the guy I just talked about. But I'm getting more and more people are contacting me. Actually, a guy yesterday wanted to know if I wanted to represent a guy. So
awesome. That's how it happened. Okay, so now we'll go to the East Coast. This question is from Derek in Halifax, Nova Scotia. He says, "Hey, Jeff, I've always been a big Red Sox fan and love watching you when you were in Boston. But know that sometimes those fans at Fenway can be ruthless. What was the wildest fan interaction you witnessed during your time in Boston?"
That's a great question. I have a good story. So we're in Fenway, and Trot Nixon, actually, and I'd already spoken out, you know, against the general manager. So a lot of the people in Boston, 50% loved me, and the other ones hated me because they just expect you to keep your mouth shut and play ball, right? So we're playing, and Trot Nixon's on deck, and he was a fan favorite. And Jimmy Williams, the manager, my nickname was Frito. He goes, "Frito, you're hitting for Trot right here." And I was like, "Are you sure, Jimmy?" Because I knew I wasn't going to get a good reception. And so all of a sudden, I say, "Trot, I'm hitting for you." And so I walk up on deck, and then all of a sudden the announcer, you know, Jimmy points up and to the umpire, and "Now batting for Trot Nixon, Jeff Fry," and the whole freaking stadium started booing,
oh, right? Man.
And I'm like, "Oh my God, this is my home. This is my, those would be I'm on your side, right? And so I'm so mad. So I'm walking up to home plate. I was just steaming mad. And I took my helmet off as I'm walking to home plate, and I tipped it to the crowd as they were all and I got in the batter's box, and the catcher and the umpire were laughing. And I got a base hit. Nice. And I got the first base, and I tipped my hat to the crowd, right? And I scored a run. And they didn't see this, but as soon as I walked in the dugout below the roof of the dugout, I went like this, right here. I was so pissed at it. So then I came up a couple innings later, and I'm almost positive it was against the Blue Jays. I came up a couple innings later, and I hit a 2-RBI double off the Green Monster, and the crowd went crazy. They loved me again.
Awesome. You got them back on side. That's
great. I was so mad. I was like, man, you can't be booing me. I'm on your team.
All right, Jeff, your last question here is from Marissa in Edmonton. So that's Alberta above Montana. She says, hey, Jeff, there's always talk that a lot of guys don't want to come to Toronto, and it's harder for them to be lured to lure big free agents. Did you notice that sentiment when you were in the league?
A little bit. And the reason was the taxes. There's like a 10% more tax than we had to pay here in the States. And right. So guys had to take that into account before you signed. So you're making $1 million, you're actually making about half that after you pay taxes here and taxes in the U.S. And I don't know if, you know, I always felt like Toronto was like a U.S. city. I mean, it wasn't like you felt like you were in a different country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I loved going to Toronto. It was so beautiful and so clean, and the stadium was awesome. And, you know, I saw, you know, when the Blue Jays were winning, you know, they were drawing 4 million fans, and yeah. It was, you know, great atmosphere. So, I mean, I knew some guys probably had apprehension to go there, but I did.
Do you think, this is a separate side here, but do you think that with the tax thing, sometimes Toronto makes up for it in their salary? Like, do you think that's sometimes built in a little?
I know the agents and the players try to make them make up for it, but
right.
You know, if Toronto's the only team calling you, there's not really much you can do about it.
Right. You just pay 10% more tax.
It's also the same in the States. You know, you play in Texas, you don't have the, you know, it's no state tax, no state income tax. But, you know, so guys will choose certain places to play that don't have state income tax, like Florida or
right.
Or Texas. Whereas, you know, if you're going to play in California, you know, the taxes are going to be higher. So the players definitely take that into account.
Jeff, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us, man. We really enjoyed this baseball chat with you. All the best. And yeah, take care, my man.
Thank you.
Awesome, man. I appreciate it. I want to tell you one last story. It'll take 1 minute.
No, that's great.
Of course. You bet.
I noticed the picture behind you on your wall of R.A. Dickey.
Yes.
Right? And I want to tell you why I knew my career was over. So in 2002, I played in AAA for the Reds in Louisville for 4 months. And I was hurt. My back was killing me. I went to the manager's office, says, man, I'm going home. This is not even enjoying this anymore. I get home, and the Houston Astros called me and want me to come play in New Orleans for a couple weeks, and hopefully they'll call me up in September. So my last game of my career for the Houston Astros, we're playing in Oklahoma City against the Rangers. And the last game, R.A. Dickey was pitching, right? And this is before he became a knuckleball pitcher.
Yeah.
So he was throwing about 88, 89. He might have touched 90. And it looked like it was about 95 to me. And I could not catch up to it. And I was like, man, I think I'm done. This dude's so on 88. And eventually,
when you're whiffing on RA's fastball, that's when you're done, eh?
And the reason he became a knuckleball pitcher because he didn't throw hard enough.
Yeah.
And he didn't have enough success. And then he turns into a knuckleball pitcher and becomes a stud, you know?
Yeah. So that's fun. Wild. Awesome. Thank you so much, Jeff. That's great.
That's a great story.
Awesome, man. Well, I appreciate you guys. Go Blue Jays.
Thanks for listening to the Walk Off Podcast with Scott Belford and Adam Mack. with a new episode every Friday.
Oh! With a drive. Cheese and crackers. Shows to pitch to him. Wrong move.
Thanks for listening.